Call the remote hearing of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee to order. Today is January 18th, 2022. This meeting is held in accordance with Rule 10.01, which was passed and allows for remote hearings. All remote hearings are recorded and live streamed by House Public Information. I have a couple of announcements. One is we have a lot of testimony for today's hearing on a variety of subjects, and it is all posted. A lot of it is posted together for ease of reading. So if you are looking for your testimony, it is on there, and I would encourage the public to look at that. Secondly, I want to introduce a new CLA, and that is Scotland Cracker. And Scotland will be joining us, and his first official ask, I'm asking you don't make it too difficult for him. His first official task will be taking the attendance by roll. Scotland.
Good morning. Chair Hansen is present. Vice Chair Wozlewick, Amy.
Wozlewick, present.
Lead Heinzman, Josh.
Present.
Acomb, Patty.
Acomb, present.
Ackland, Susan.
Ackland, present.
Backer, Jeff. Backer, Jeff. Becker, Finn, Jamie. Becker, Finn, Jamie. Eklund, Rob.
Eklund, present.
Fisher, Peter. Fisher, Peter. Green, Steve.
Present.
Igo, Spencer. Igo, Spencer. Jordan, Sydney.
Jordan, present.
Keeler, Heather.
Keeler, present.
Lee, Fu.
Lee, present.
Lippert, Todd.
Lippert, present.
Lewick, Dale. Lewick, Dale. Morrison, Kelly.
Morrison, present.
Nelson, Nathan.
Nelson, present.
Tice, Tama.
Tice, present.
All right. Backer, Jeff.
Yeah, Backer, present.
Becker, Finn, Jamie. Igo, Spencer. Lewick, Dale.
Igo is in a meeting. He'll be here shortly.
All right. Thank you.
And a quorum is present. Representative Fisher got called into a meeting at his work, so if he could be considered excused. And I think that is it. Good job, Scotland. Members, our first presentation today is on the Metropolitan Landfill Contingency Account Trust, or MLCAT. We had some activity on this in 2021, but we wanted to follow up in 2022 with this. With the surplus, there's a great opportunity to pay past debts. And we have Representative Ruth Richardson, who is the author of the MLCAT bill, here to give some brief remarks, and then folks from the Pollution Control Agency and from Dakota. Representative Richardson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for prioritizing this hearing today on refunding the Metropolitan Landfill Contingency Action Trust. Last session, we made an incremental step forward by securing an appropriation for $100,000 annually to begin the repayment process. And I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for your leadership and many people who are on this call today that have been champions, including Commissioner Slavik and the Minnesota Intercounty Association. Unfortunately, the progress that was made last session falls far short of the bill that we introduced last year, House File 836, which would have required a repayment of the $13.9 million that was taken from the fund. The importance of the restoration of funding is tied to public health, it's tied to environmental justice, and also ensuring that we will be well balanced to address any emergency threats that might arise, and also maintaining long-term care of the landfills. We have an opportunity this session, as you just talked about, with historic surplus funding to restore funding and ensure that communities are protected. It's a matter of health, it's a matter of safety, and it's a level of protection that impacted communities and families deserve. And so thank you for the opportunity to present today, and looking forward to continued conversation and hoping that we can get the restoration of funding that is so desperately needed.
Members, are there any questions for Representative Richardson? Thank you. I know you've got another meeting to go to, so as many of us are double booked, but thank you for your work on this effort.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next up, we have Hans Knave with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Oh, I'm off in my schedule. Jamie Wallerstedt, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Welcome.
Good morning. Can you all hear me okay?
I can, yeah. Maybe turn it up a little bit, just a little more volume.
Okay, let me try this. And we do have our slides up, so I think we are ready to go. Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jamie Wallerstedt, and I'm the Division Director of the Remediation Division at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I also have with me Hans Knave, the manager of the Closed Landfill Program and Technical Services section at Remediation, where these landfills are managed out of. So we appreciate the opportunity to come talk about these landfills today. Next slide. So we're here to talk about the Metropolitan Landfill Contingency Action Trust, also called MLCAT. We refer them as MLCAT. It was established in 1984 with a goal to cover long-term care at certain metropolitan closed landfills that accepted mixed municipal solid waste. In 1994, a majority of the landfills that were eligible, MLCAT eligible landfills, were moved into the closed landfill program. But there are seven landfills, and I'll go through those on the next slide, that are still eligible for MLCAT because they are not eligible for the closed landfill program. And the funds are to provide emergency funding and long-term care for the remaining eligible landfills in the metro area. So this slide shows that the MLCAT eligible landfills are seven remaining landfills. Four of them are closed. They were construction and demolition landfills that accepted a small amount of mixed municipal solid waste. Bijan is located in Plymouth and Hennepin County. Herbst and Sons is located in New Brighton and Ramsey County. Rosemount is located in Dakota County, and then Badness Heights located in Ramsey County. There's one unpermitted dump, the Pig's Eye Dump, located in St. Paul, and then two open landfills, which are Burnsville and Pine Bend, both located in Dakota County. The open landfills, once they are closed, they would be eligible for emergency actions during the 30-year closure or post-closure period. And if the landfill owner does not take required action. So next slide. The fund is sourced by two different sources of funds. The first is 25% of the landfill fee, the Metropolitan Solid Waste Landfill fee, is deposited into the MLCAT fund for the two remaining open funds that are MLCAT eligible. So that equates to the fee is about $6.66 that goes per ton that goes into the MLCAT fund. And over the last 5 years, the historical average is just under $1 million going into the fund. The other source of funds is actually investment revenues by the State Board of Investment. In 2016, $8.1 million from the Milcat was transferred to the State Board of Investments for management, and that was required by law. Next slide. So there has been a series of legislative transfers, and I'll go through those next. The first one was in 2003, when $9.9 million was transferred from Milcat to the general fund. The legislation did have payback language, however, those funds have not been repaid to date. Next slide. In 2005, there was another transfer, which included $4 million from Milcat to the Renewable Development Account. Again, there was payback language included in the legislation. However, these funds have not been repaid as well. And then in 2015, there was a transfer, the third and final transfer, of $8.1 million from Milcat to the general fund. And in this one, in November of 2015, there was a surplus projected in the budget forecast, and the entire $8.1 million was repaid at that time. So in summary, there have been three transfers. From Milcat to other sources. The ones in 2003 and 2005, which approximate approximately $14 million in total, have not been repaid. However, in 2021 session law, beginning in fiscal year 2022, $100,000 annually is to be transferred from the general fund to the Milcat account under a repayment plan. So under this plan, it would take approximately 140 years to pay back the nearly $14 million. And then this slide summarizes our balances in the two different accounts. So the first one is the State Board of Investments account. As of January 10th, 2022, the account in the State Board of Investments totals approximately $16 million. And then in the MPCA's project funds, it totals $4.6 million for a total balance. And I apologize for the typo. It's actually $20.6 million in total. All right, so then I wanted to go through the four closed sites at this point in time. And then the closed dump pig's eye will be a next topic later on in the agenda. But for the four closed demolition landfills, the first one is Bijan Dump and Demolition Landfill in Plymouth. The MPCA has completed a soil investigation. There also was mitigation done on the on-site building by the owner. Work in progress. We currently need to complete a groundwater investigation as PFAS and 1,4-dioxane were detected at this landfill. We have looked for nearby drinking water wells. There is no drinking water wells in the area, so no risk to drinking water at this time. And then we also are going to be completing a vapor intrusion investigation surrounding the landfill. Pending those results, further mitigation may be necessary. And then we will be continuing to monitor the groundwater out here as well. Next slide. The next one is Herbst & Sons Demolition Landfill in New Brighton. The work completed that the MPCA completed previously is we've completed a soil vapor investigation. Work in progress is we are going to be completing a soil investigation out there to determine the extent of the waste to the north and the northwest. Groundwater and a groundwater investigation is necessary out here. We have detected PFAS in the groundwater. There are no drinking water wells in the area, so there's no risk to drinking water at this time. But we do need to understand how far the contamination has gone. So we will be installing monitoring wells as part of our next steps, and then continued monitoring. Rosemount Demolition Landfill is our next one. We have completed a soil investigation out there, so the limits of the waste is known. We've also installed monitoring wells. We have started a vapor investigation at this landfill. We do need to be doing more. As you can see, there are townhomes to the west of the landfill, as you can see on the photo there. To date, no townhomes have needed vapor mitigation systems. However, we still do need to pursue access at a couple of the townhomes. Again, PFAS and 1,4-dioxane have been detected in the groundwater. But again, everybody is hooked up to municipal water out here. There's no wells in the area. So drinking water is not at risk at this time. Vapor mitigation may be necessary. However, like I said previously, no buildings needed to be mitigated previously, and we will need to be doing continued monitoring out here. And then the last one is Van Ness Heights Demolition Landfill. This one, we have completed our soil investigation, so the extent of the waste is known. We've also installed monitoring wells. The work in progress for this year is that we will be doing a soil vapor investigation. We have started that. No off-site buildings have needed mitigation at this time, but we do still need to gain access to a couple of properties and finish that work. And then we do also need to complete some groundwater monitoring. PFAS has also been detected at this well in the groundwater. We have found a couple of wells. None are used for drinking water. And actually more than half of them have already been abandoned. All the people out here are hooked up to city drinking water, so there are no drinking water risks. But we do need to sample a couple of private wells that potentially were used for irrigation at some point in time.
Ms. Wallerson,
and our next,
if I could interrupt, Representative Heintzman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can hold off. I thought that Jamie had said that this was the last slide, so I was wanting to jump in.
Proceed.
I can wait. So.
Proceed. Sounds good. I can keep going. Okay, thank you. Our next steps, like I said, are a vapor mitigation if the investigation states that it's warranted, and then we will need to continue monitoring out here as well. And then I just have one last slide, which is just a combination to bring all the costs together. We have spent, since fiscal year 18, the agency has spent approximately $835,000 at these four sites. And as you can see, in fiscal year 22, we're planning to spend $460,000. And then the subsequent 5 years, we are planning to spend upwards of $2.45 million at these four sites. So with that, I can take any questions that you have.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry for interrupting earlier. I thought I was at the right moment, but just a comment. First of all, Mr. Chair, we went through a number of slides that walked us through quite a significant amount of money that has been distributed outside of, I think, its intended subject area of impact. And that was helpful, but I am wondering, I guess maybe suggesting more than anything else, if we pay back the landfill funds, I would think that we should use money from wherever the money went in the past, right? So If it was dumped into general fund, I'm suggesting that it should come back out of general fund back into the account. And I know that that wasn't necessarily covered in the presentation, but just wanted to maybe get some feedback from you, Mr. Chair, or anybody else that might have comments. I think that RDA there was there, and then there was some other stuff as well. But a question that might not be possible to answer at the moment, Ms. Wallerstedt, would be, and it would be nice to get a breakdown on some of the solid waste tax revenues and how much goes to counties in SCORE grants and how much goes to MPCA. It'd be good to know exactly how MPCA uses the money internally. I know that wasn't covered specifically in the presentation, but it was a question that was on my mind as we're looking at those dollars coming into the agency and, of course, being collected from fees as folks are coming into their local landfills or when they pay for garbage collection and so on. So it'd be good to know kind of how that money is used, as well as the plan to try to make sure that these funds are reimbursed and how they're going to be reimbursed, where that's going to be coming from.
Ms. Wallerstedt.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. We do have that breakdown, and we can provide it after this meeting. I don't have it with me, but we can provide it after.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Heisman, is that okay?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, obviously we're going to be having some meetings in the coming month, so if that might fit into a presentation as we get more conversation on this subject area and potentially legislation, I would think that would be helpful in decision-making. So thank you.
I was thinking maybe you wanted to increase the dedication of the solid waste revenues towards their intended purpose. Maybe that's what you were looking
for. I think that we're heading in the right direction with that sort of thought. Yes, Mr. Chair.
And to your first question, you know, I think just as anecdotally, it might be harder to recover the money from the RDA than from the general fund, but clearly we have a large general fund surplus, and these amounts that were posted are just the amounts that were taken back in 03 and 05.
So. Mr. Chair.
Representative Heitzman.
Thank you. So I wouldn't disagree. I think that we both would probably come to the same conclusion that it would be hard to recover those dollars from the RDA, but it would be, I think, very beneficial to understand what MPCA is doing with the money. And if it isn't spending it as it was intended, if it's going into other subject areas or I think a whole host of potential places it could be going, number one, we should know that. And then number two, there should be some accountability for that. And it should be paid back, even if it isn't necessarily easy. That would be my take on it.
Representative Wasluck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if Jamie can tell me this or maybe someone else, but I'm wondering, you know, without that $14 million, what sort of investment return would there have been if that $14 million had been part of that fund? Do we have any sense of those numbers?
Ms. Wallerstedt.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. You know, I don't have that information at this point in time. However, if part of it was invested with the State Board of Investments, there would have been a return, because the rest, the $8.1 million that is invested with the State Board of Investments has grown in value.
Representative Wasluck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we could get that number at some point, you know, I know we don't have it right now, but if we could maybe get an estimate of what that amount would be, I think that would be helpful for the committee to understand what were, not just the amount that got transferred and moved around, but the amount that we missed out on that could have been invested. Thank you.
And Ms. Wallerstedt, is it safe to say then, just that last couple of slides, that there are, in separate from the Pig's Eye dump, but just the existing closed landfills, your costs are increasing with monitoring, particularly if we have to look at vapor intrusion and PFAS movement. Is that a correct statement?
Representative, yes, our costs are increasing. We started the investigation in 2018, and we will have to be doing more monitoring, particularly with more well installations as well, monitoring well installations.
And is it the Rosemont site that has the closest homes to it?
Representative, I would have to check to see the distance, but Van Ness Heights also has residential homes to the north of the landfill. So I would say those two landfills have the closest homes.
Members, any other questions for Ms. Wallerstedt? Okay, thank you. Next we'll go to Hans Knave.
Well, actually, Hans's presentation was mine, so I think it's the next agenda item with Dave Benke.
Actually, I think we have Mike Slavik with Dakota County Board is going to provide testimony.
Thank you.
And then I'll just go to Committee Administrator Mr. Strohmeyer to point out the testimony that we've received in writing. But let's go with Mr. Slavik.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike Slavik. I am on the Dakota County Board as well as today representing, I'm on the Board of Directors for the Association of Minnesota Counties. This is also a priority for the Association of Minnesota Counties. To begin, I just want to start by thanking the work that was done last year and the continuing of $100,000, because at least it is a start, and that is greatly appreciated getting through this point in here. As was stated with the MPCA, there are seven eligible landfills that are included in MLCAT. Five of them are closed. The two that are remaining that are generating revenue towards MLCAT are the two in Dakota County. That is the Burnsville and the Pine Bend landfill. Those have quite large footprints, and we are concerned as a county, but also as a state, that the existing and the estimated balance that will likely be needed to support the necessary post-closure actions of the remaining three, Pig's Eye, Burnsville, and Pine Bend, are insufficient and will not be able to address the cost, particularly with the almost $14 million that has been removed from this fund. We are very supportive of this bill to go in and to ensure that the funds are available for the post-closure, particularly the footprints of, as I said, the two Dakota County landfills are quite large and will take resources well beyond what is able to be addressed with that. So, with that, I just extend our appreciation for the work that's been done and also our support as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, are there any questions for Commissioner Slavik? Just to clarify, you're speaking on behalf of not only the county, but the whole statewide Association of Minnesota Counties. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, we are going to be still in Dakota County, and it's an overview and update on the Burnsville Sanitary Landfill. Dave Benke, Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, sorry to interrupt.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, I had a question. I'm not sure if this would be for Ms. Wallerstedt or someone else at some point in the conversation, because it's more a broader question about MLCAT, but do we have a projection for when that money, maybe someone covered this, do we have a projection for when that money would run out given the costs of what it costs to maintain the closed landfills plus what we know are the landfills that will be closing in the future? Do we have any projections on that? I'm just wondering if we could get someone either to address that now or later. I just didn't want to miss the opportunity to address that.
Well, we're on MLCAP. Ms. Wallerstedt or Commissioner Slavik, when does the money run out at the current rate of spending?
Chair and representative, at the current rate of spending, I'll go through this when we conclude the Pig's Eye presentation as well, but currently we will be, by 2027, we'll be 3/4 of the way through it.
And Representative Wozlawick?
That was my question. Thanks, Mr. Chair, for letting me jump in there.
And that's without any new tasks or with new cleanup. Is that correct, Ms. Waller?
Chair, that is correct.
Commissioner Slavik, you want to weigh in on that or any?
I have nothing further to add to that. That's what we're aware of as well.
Any other questions on MLCAP? Seeing none, we will go to the Burnsville landfill. Dave Benke, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dave Benke. I'm the director of the Resource Management and Assistance Division at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. We've got the oversight of the solid waste activities that we're going to be talking about today as I update you on the Burnsville Sanitary Landfill Project. Next slide. The location of the project, as you can see from this slide, is property in Burnsville. It's west of I-35 and just north of Highway 13. So that just gives you kind of a location. Also, it's in Dakota County. Next slide, please. The project itself is proposed to increase the mixed municipal solid waste disposal capacity for the landfill. That's the garbage that you and I consider trash as we take it up to the curbs every week. The project would increase Burnsville Sanitary Landfill's permanent total capacity from the current 28.6 million cubic yards to 45 million cubic yards. That's an increase of MSW capacity of 16.4 million cubic yards. They also propose to convert some of their current permitted industrial waste disposal capacity to mixed municipal solid waste, approximately 7.2 million cubic yards would be converted from the industrial waste to mixed municipal solid waste capacity, totaling 23.6 million cubic yards in capacity increase. That would also increase the permitted peak elevation of the facility from its current level of 820 feet to about 1,082 feet, an increase of about 262 feet for the elevation. It would also modify their current footprint, which is the area that the landfill sits on, which would be an actual reduction. They would modify some of their design to decrease the footprint from 216 acres to 204 acres. They still would remain outside of the 100-year floodplain from the Minnesota River, as required by rule. And it would increase the operating life of the mixed municipal solid waste portion of the landfill about 49 years, from 2023 to 2062. So it's an increase of quite a bit in terms of not only volume, but also of years of capacity. The next slide talks about the processes that we are going through on the facility. And I'd like to kind of run through these and give you an update on where we're at with each one of these. As you can see, they have both regional application as well as site-specific application, and we'll go through them in that order. The first is the solid waste planning, and that's done on a regional scale for the orderly and deliberate development of the waste facilities for the metro area. This includes the Metro Policy Plan, which is a regional document that guides how the waste is managed for each one of the metro counties. The counties then create their own master plan, which incorporates the goals and objectives of that and the programs that they will implement to get there. The other regional process is the Certificate of Need process, which is the regional determination of how much landfill space we're going to need. The next area is the Environmental Review, which provides decision makers with usable information on the environmental effects of the project. It starts to get into more site-specific issues. The impact statement, which is required for the Burnsville Sanitary Landfill, came about because of the size of the expansion. The EIS must be both, it must be analytical and describe the proposed action, and it must also analyze its environmental impacts, discuss alternatives, and explore how the impacts could be mitigated. In and of itself, the environmental review isn't a decision-making document. It's an information-sharing document for others who might have to permit or manage the facility long term. Once the need for the facility is established through the planning process and looked at under the environmental review, then we can get to the permitting portion. Information from the planning and the environmental review process informs that permit, and then we can look at the actual conditions and so forth of how the facility will be managed to protect the environment. While this looks like a linear process that goes from one step to the next, there are feedback loops within these processes and also determinations that can't be made from one step to another. As an example, the determination for the certificate of need, although it's in the planning area, actually can't be made until after the environmental review process. They both inform each other as well with the permitting process. Next slide, please. So if we look at the planning process itself, the Metro Policy Plan, that's the goals and objectives of the metro area to actually manage the waste from solid waste management, recycling, composting, household hazardous waste management, all the things that the counties in the metro area and the businesses and the landfills and everything do with the waste in the area. The goals are aimed to decrease landfilling overall, and you know, that's the hierarchy that I'll talk a little bit more later on, but we really want to make sure that we utilize other management tools before we get to landfilling. The Metro Policy Plan is currently the one that we approved in 2017. We have a new one targeted for initial release for comment this coming summer. The certificate of need process, on the other hand, is really about how much landfill space is needed. In the summer of 2020, the MPCA opened up the certificate of need process, allowing existing or new metro facilities to apply for MSW capacity. We had an 180-day application period, and we got four facilities that applied for certificate of need. We also of note, in 2019, the Great River Energy Waste Energy Facility in Elk River closed, and that was one of the conditions that we needed to make sure that all the processing facilities were full before we issued certificate of need. With that closure, all of the facilities were full, and we could go ahead and issue that. The respondents to the application for certificate of need included four landfills in the metro area. The next slide shows their locations, and that is the DEMCON facility in Shakopee, the Burnsville Sanitary Landfill, which we're talking about today. We've got the Pine Bend Sanitary Landfill in Invergrove Heights, as well as the SKB Landfill in Invergrove Heights. Both SKB and DEMCON would be new mixed municipal solid waste facilities. They do not currently accept that. They accept demolition and industrial waste and would need to go through both the environmental review and permitting processes as well as before receiving that certificate of need. And if there's environmental review needed, they need to complete that as well. Pine Bend, on the other hand, has completed their environmental review. We've issued their certificate of need, and they're incorporating that into their permit. Next slide. So for Burnsville, we're right in the middle of the environment, well, at the tail end of the environmental review process. We needed to do environmental review, actually an environmental impact statement for this facility based on the capacity that they were applying for and how much more than their current. We have done environmental impact statements previous at this facility. They were completed in 1981. In 91 and 2005. And so what we conducted here was called a supplemental environmental impact statement that builds on those previous environmental impact statements. We scoped what needed to be updated and provided that scoping document and then created the environmental impact statement from that. So it really supplements what was done in the past. Again, the approval of the environmental review really isn't an approval of the project itself. It just ensures that information can be shared with others who are going to be permitting or manage that facility long term. We have wrapped up the initial stage of the environmental review, where we posted a public notice on the supplemental environmental impact statement, have addressed the comments in that, and now we're finalizing comments on the adequacy of the supplemental environmental impact statement, which will be the last step that will also be noticed in the Environmental Quality Board monitor. So that will be our next and final steps. Next slide talks a little bit about, if you go back one to the permitting slide, or you've got that there. The permitting slide addresses where we're at with the facility now. Our permit application for this facility was deemed complete in November of 21. Currently, staff are performing the technical adequacy review of the facility permit application. They're looking at the design, the operations, the environmental monitoring, and the contingency actions. They're also looking at the, long-term needs of the facility, but also we're looking at a permit timeline that is a 10-year permit issuance based on a lesser amount or limited time for certificate of need. So even though this facility is proposed to, have capacity for 49 years, we're also looking at it in a shorter time frame in terms of permit issuance and certificate of need. And the reason for that is really on the next slide. You know, we know that you can't manage waste without having impacts. And so, there's three things that I see you can do with waste. You can prevent it, you can manage it, or you can clean it up. And by driving waste up the Minnesota waste management hierarchy, we recover resources and we reduce the need for disposal or landfilling of the waste. So focusing on efforts that are at the top of the hierarchy have the biggest environmental benefits, and the planning and efforts that the counties, the solid waste industry, and others do to manage that waste other than disposal really help move that along.
Mr. Benke, Ms. Representative Jordan has a question. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad we're stopped on this slide, actually. So, Mr. Maggie, can you talk a little bit about how plastics have and goods that could be recycled? What big a problem? I see that we're focusing on the top hierarchy, but can you talk a little bit about plastics and other things that we know could be recycled? I understand that we've seen a reduction in China's willingness to take our recycled goods and repurpose them. Can you talk about how changes in the recycling landscape have impacted the need to expand landfilling, and how ideally we could avoid putting things in landfills that could be recycled or composted?
Mr. Benke.
Mr. Chair and members, that's a great question. And, you know, one of the things that we benefited from was having local markets for materials in Minnesota. Most of the East Coast and the West Coast relied on Asian markets for their recycling, but we have in the state manufacturers of post-consumer materials from recycled product. So we have plastics manufacturers, paper, metal, the whole end of things. And that's been really important in us moving things up that hierarchy. Over half the waste that we generate in the state does get recycled. But we do have goals that are higher than that. And so we need to concentrate on the organics fraction, materials that can be recycled. So we've started to look at our waste with a materials management perspective from a sustainable standpoint. What are the biggest environmental impacts from the various materials? And what results would we have if we recover those? If recovery doesn't have the biggest benefits, targeting those materials for prevention or not generating in the first place is another area that we're looking at. So I think we've been you know, benefited greatly by having those markets, but we continue to advocate for market development within the state to manage the various materials, including plastics. You know, plastics are prevalent throughout, you know, our waste stream, and looking at the different pieces of and products that are made out of plastic, we want to then target those potentially if they can be recovered and then recycled. We want to make sure that that'll happen. But if you think about digging through a pile of garbage, it gets harder and harder as things get mixed. Mechanical separation of the materials happens at our materials recovery facilities, but it requires a big effort to do that. Materials that could come directly from industrial sources or that end could help. But once it gets mixed, it gets harder and harder. So prevention is probably a big key to reducing some of that. Reusables are all a way to do that. So the next slide really, I think, addresses some of that too. What can we do? Obviously, we've got the reduce, reuse, recycle in our minds, reducing where we can, recovering materials for recycling that can help us reach those goals in the metropolitan area. But really taking a harder look at the materials themselves and what environmental impacts they have along the way from the extraction to the manufacturing to the use and seeing where those could be eliminated. So that's what I have for you on the Burnsville landfill. Any other questions? I'd be glad to take those.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Benke, for that. That's very helpful. I'm also curious, the solutions seem to be very focused on consumers and making that personal choice to make sure that you are recycling and sorting your materials. But we know that our consumers in Minnesota actually do a very good job of that. And I'm not sure, I'm wondering what the MPCA would recommend beyond just putting this on consumers. What other policy changes need to happen to reduce landfilling? I mean, when I'm looking at this plan, where I'm seeing plans for a mountain that's larger than the ski hill at Bush Lake, this means that the highest elevation rates in some of these counties could be mountains of trash versus natural landmarks. It's pretty clear that we have a problem beyond what just people are doing and which container they put their waste in. So what else needs to be done to reduce reuse and recycle, you know, at the top of our hierarchy beyond just asking Minnesotans to keep recycling? And then I'm also curious about in-state demand for these recycled products and what needs to be done from the state to make sure that we're actually utilizing those recycled products with our markets here in state.
Becky.
Mr. Chair and members, I think I'll address the last question first, and if I miss any parts of that, please just remind me. But the market development piece is really important for us, not only in creating the manufacturers that can create the products from the materials, but then making sure that those products in the end can be utilized. We've worked on a lot of purchasing within the state system from recycled content paper to looking at compost and making sure that our projects that we do as a state incorporate those in terms of specifications and requirements. We also want to encourage others who are utilizing those materials from the same end to understand how the materials can be used and what myths that we sometimes have to bust, so to speak, on some of these recycled content materials. People assume that they don't work as well, but they perform just as well as other products made with virgin materials. In terms of what we need to concentrate on, we do a little bit of assessment of the waste stream every 10 years or so, and that's another area that we need to continue to work on, is to figure out what's in the waste stream, what's being disposed of, and where it's coming from. And can we encourage materials that are difficult to recycle to become manufactured in a way that they can encourage disassembly, can encourage reuse, repair for our manufacturers in the state, and encourage that dialogue elsewhere. So sustainability on materials does start before the consumer, and those dialogues and discussions are happening too. So we are working at it, I think, along the chain of custody of these materials, trying to get upstream to make sure the materials are created in a way where people are thinking about that design for the end life of them as well. So our product stewardship efforts with electronics and with paint so far have included the manufacturers in the discussion as well.
Representative Jordan, follow up, and then we'll go to Representative Acom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Franke. You kind of touched on something I was curious about there at the end where we were talking about producer responsibility. We've seen some great success with our e-waste producer stewardship program and paint cans. I know I've carried carpet stewardship work in the past, and we know mattresses, but I'm wondering about what else needs to be done to hold these producers accountable. For example, you know, I go to Target or wherever to purchase laundry detergent. I have a lot of choices of what smell of laundry detergent I have, but every single product comes in a large plastic tub. Which is then, you know, I try to recycle them, but we know that that's a problem. So what else is being done to hold these producers accountable, and what else does the legislature need to do to step in?
Mr. Benke.
Mr. Chair and members, I think a lot of that starts with dialogue and discussion with the manufacturers to understand our system a little bit better and how they can participate in recovery and those kind of things here. And so I think there's a need for dialogue, and those dialogues on those various materials that you mentioned earlier, I think are really important to happen to not only make sure that we encourage the reuse and the recycling of the materials, but also create opportunities for businesses to begin recycling of some of those materials here, right here in the state. And so I think those are some things that, you know, in terms of policy and connection can be all looked at in terms of the materials. One of the things that you mentioned about the size of the landfill, I think, are really important. Having land disposal in the state that people can actually see and understand what's going on really provides a good incentive to look for alternatives because it isn't being sent away. It isn't somewhere that we don't see or come in contact. It's visible, and it will be visible, but we've got to continue to make progress if we want to reduce that. We only, you know, I say only, but because it's a huge amount still, but only a third or less of the waste that we generate ends up in landfills. So we're managing two-thirds of it in other ways, and that's a positive. But we still have a ways to go in terms of management of the materials.
Representative Acom, and then Representative Wasluck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the presentation. I think that as I consider mountains of trash, it becomes concerning, especially when we think about our changing climate. And we know we have a lot more large rain events. And so, you know, the thoughts or possibility of contaminating water is a big deal. And so wondering what you all are doing, or if you're taking climate change into effect or into account as you're coming up with management ideas or solutions. And if so, what are you doing around, so I guess exactly what are you doing around climate to address this issue?
Mr. Benke.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the area of climate impact and environmental impact from the management of the materials is really important for the agency. We've taken a look at things through a little bit different lens that I mentioned earlier, and that's through sustainable materials management, taking a look at the materials, not just on a disposal end or can it be recycled, but what are the impacts of that material from an environmental standpoint, from a climate standpoint, and what are the highest materials that we should be going after. We've looked at food waste and food recovery before it becomes waste. And those are some of the higher ends of things that really can help from a greenhouse gas, but from an environmental impact standpoint. So targeting food recovery does a couple things. It helps from an environmental standpoint, but then it also helps from this food insecurity standpoint that we know a lot of people in the state face as well. So that's one area. I'd be happy to share more sustainable material management concepts with you if you'd like, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bacon.
Can I just follow up real quick? And I appreciate the focus on sustainable materials. And I just wondering, what about those? So what about the larger rain events and the impacts on the waste streams, especially when you talk about when we have to envision mountains of waste? What's being done to address that? So I appreciate trying to divert things or use things that are more sustainable. Once it's there, what are you doing to try and prevent contamination?
Mr. Benke.
From a disposal and management, and you know, I think that's where the permitting and rules come into play, looking at not only the current data that exists, but looking forward in terms of what are the predictions for rain events and so forth. Land disposal facilities, you know, are out there in the elements, so making sure that they can get the proper management of the water that might come in contact on top of the waste through the leachate collection, through the diversion of the stormwater and management, so that there aren't impacts from that standpoint. So the permitting of the facilities takes into that account. But the real way to get at that, I think, is to try and reduce the amount of waste that we need to landfill through the reduction and the recovery aspects of the waste hierarchy.
Representative Makem, follow-up. Representative Wasilek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Benke, you mentioned the analysis of the waste stream that's done every 10 years or so. And in Ms. Wallerstedt's presentation earlier, she mentioned a couple of specific chemicals that kept showing up at these landfill sites, PFAS and 1,4-dioxin in particular. Is that part of this waste stream analysis? Is there, like, do you look at the chemicals you're finding as well and think about where those are coming from and the sources of those, or is it more like the actual physical objects that are showing up in landfills?
Mr. Benke.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do look at the waste stream for the contents of it and look at potential pollutants that might be within various products. But we also look at the management at the facilities. The leachate that I mentioned, or the water that comes through the waste before it is managed. We look at the contaminants that may be in there and look for management techniques that we can use to look at that part of the leachate and manage that. We also monitor the sites, the groundwater within the area for contamination, so we don't have a leak or some other contamination that's going in to the groundwater from these facilities. So the permitting, the techniques are there from that end of it. But we also need to, once we find that or those materials in the leachate, to think about going upstream and finding out what products are contributing to that problem with the leachate or that are ending up in the landfill, and are there alternatives that we can use or recovery techniques that we can use to get those materials out of the landfill or out of the disposal stream so they don't have those problems on it. We will be looking at the issues that you raised in terms of chemical testing potentially with this landfill for an increased number of things to look at. That we're learning about, including PFAS and other things.
Representative Wasilek.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. That was a great answer, so I will stop there. Thanks.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Benke. So as we are seeking to address climate change, one thing that I'm very concerned about is methane emissions. And we need to be thinking about methane emissions at landfills and capturing those emissions. So I'm curious, you know, what opportunities you see if you're taking the capturing of methane emissions into account, just how you're thinking about that issue and really trying to capture those methane emissions.
Mr. Benke.
Mr. Chair and members, you know, the methane emissions from landfills are very important to manage properly. In the case of the projects that we're looking at, who have volumes enough to look at recovering methane for energy recovery and for other purposes, we make sure that the collection system is there to then utilize the methane as a gas resource rather than collecting, flaring, or other destruction options. So with this facility, they are looking at managing that methane to recover it so that they can run it through engines and create electricity as well. So that's the other aspect of the emissions that I failed to talk about, and that's the air stuff. You know, you've got methane emissions that are going to be during the operating life, but then long after the facility too, that need to be considered for management as we look at that. So the permit conditions around that look towards that recovery aspect first, and where it's doable, have the, you know, them implement recovery options to generate electricity from the methane.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Benke. I'm very, very encouraged to hear that methane capture is and use for energy is something that's being integrated into this project. That's extremely important going forward.
I don't see any other questions. I have two kind of difficult questions, Mr. Benke. One is, you know, the pyramids have been around a long time, but we're now producing a large amount of garbage, and it seems that all landfills will eventually leak sooner or later. What man builds time and nature affect at some point. And so how do we deal with that eventuality of the leaking of the landfill? The second, and I know Representative Heintzman has a question, so I'll just go with mine right now to get it done with, is you know, during COVID, we've had changes in a number of products that as you react for health and safety, we saw in the retail market for food, individual plastic wrapping, clamshell boxes, et cetera. If we went into a gas station to get a coffee, you couldn't bring your refillable cup in. So then every coffee cup was disposed of. And then masks are appearing on the ground. And I'm assuming those are going into solid waste. But do we need to be doing something as those dramatic changes when we're dealing with a crisis? Kind of the last thing we think about is disposal, but we have to deal with disposal. And, you know, when we go to a park, often there is a collection site for dog waste. Do we need to have collection sites for masks to ensure they don't appear out in the open, or how do we deal with these changes in the new normal of packaging that came for health and safety that may be either increasing or affecting the waste stream? I know that's a huge question as well.
Mr. Chair, in terms of the collection of the waste, I think it's always important to have the options available to collect that waste. And the idea of creating some specific for masks and other things is something that we probably need to consider. But the most important piece is to create the system that can actually get the materials disposed of in a, you know, orderly, deliberate way, but also in a safe way. We, I think, are implementing the best available technologies, but you're right. The future will show how well those technologies work. And the best thing for us to do is to move waste up that hierarchy and recover it in ways that don't require the disposal in. So even though we've been looking at a project that has a lifespan of potentially 50 years, in discussions with Rotary clubs, cities, others, it's all been about, well, we're going to do better with our recycling or move things further up that hierarchy. And that's where I think we need to make the emphasis, create the opportunities to manage the waste that give us not only better environmental benefits, but better economic benefits for the use of the waste as well. You know, I think the long-term look at disposal, you know, I think we need to try and take a look at how we can change things. But also in looking at that packaging, looking at the use of the products, making sure that we're looking at it from that sustainable materials management end. If you properly wrap a food and preserve it so that it can be consumed and it doesn't get wasted, does that packaging then have a role in waste prevention of the food itself? And so doing the analysis to consider that, I think, becomes real important. And then making sure that we've got the management methods in place to properly handle those materials, I think, is really key too.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had not planned on talking, so I apologize for coming in late. And I think Mr. Vinke's just comment a second ago about trying to find the right processes to manage this problem is where I'm headed with my point. And you can probably see where I'm going to go with this. We've had lots of conversations about MPCA's role in working to solve the PFAS problem. But quite honestly, it's incredibly frustrating as a legislator watching this process, because in some cases, MPCA has actually contributed to killing recycling programs around the state. And I'm not hearing about any solutions in the presentation today to that problem. PFAS and the chemicals around PFAS are forever chemicals. We all understand that. The problem is that all we seem to be able to talk about is the upstream problem. The problem is here and in everybody's garage and in everybody's house around the entire country. We have to figure out a way to continue to allow diversion programs for waste and other programs to deal with even things as simple as lawn clippings without screwing up the process of permitting and killing industry that's trying to work on those programs to keep waste out of landfills. And I'm not hearing any solutions from MPCA. If there are proposals or there's legislation or there's something that MPCA needs, we need to know about that, and the sooner the better. Just looking upstream is only half of the solution. And I'm hoping that I missed part of the presentation, but I've been here staring at the monitor and listening throughout the entire discussion and listening to the answers that are coming to the questions that I think are great questions from my colleagues on the other side of the aisle. But I'm thinking as I'm listening, it may be unfortunate that the public isn't getting the other half of this from MPCA, because unfortunately, many of these programs that they are working to try to support by putting waste into different bins and so on and so forth isn't getting actually to the end goal, which is diverting a lot of these materials to landfills. We're in situations now where grass clippings are going into landfills because people can't access those businesses that previously had allowed them to have those products recycled into compost. And that's more of a statement, Mr. Chair, so I apologize for that. But you know, that's kind of where I get frustrated listening to this discussion, because half of the reality that we're facing, I think, is missing from this conversation.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, I do think that if we want to have a further discussion about PFAS, I think it would be good to bring in folks who've been involved in our blueprint and have further discussions on that. I apologize for not including that in this presentation. This was, you know, on the Burnsville landfill, and it's kind of grown with the questions on the whole waste management hierarchy, but I appreciate that comment and knowing how to deal with what we have in terms of legacy waste is really important. Also planning for the future to make sure that we aren't creating additional legacy waste is important as well. So we do need to be working on both ends of that at the same time. So I appreciate that comment as well.
Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Benke. I know it comes across as very negative, but I'm glad to hear that you understand the problem the same way I do. I think probably you know it better than I do. That's your area of expertise. But the frustration is building, and at some point, it has to be handled. And it is such a serious issue. It's going to continue to paralyze industry that is passionate about solving this problem of landfills and the amount of material going into landfills. But if we regulate ourselves into a further problem, is that really a solution? And I think we all know that that isn't the solution. It's got to be both the upstream and the downstream together. And I'm not hearing solutions. And quite honestly, when I look at the blueprint, I don't see the downstream solutions as much as I see the focus on regulatory solutions upstream. Like I said, it's forever chemicals. They are there. So there's got to be. But thank you, Mr. Chair, for the indulgence. Let me speak to that. It's obviously something we're all passionate about.
Heinzman, we've got a lot of work to do in the next few weeks, and you know, I think the unique thing about this session is there may be some opportunity to help resolve some of these with some additional dollars, both at the federal and the state level. I know that that may not be the only option, but it's something different than what we've had before. And I'll go with Representative Backer, and then we've got to get to our last presentation. We've got a number of testifiers. So Representative Backer.
Yeah, I'll be brief. Thank you, Chair. You know, I'm going to ditto what Representative Heisman. One of the things that on this side of the state, people drive 70, 75 miles literally to go into North Dakota and South Dakota because of their waste. And we have to really start to think, is that really smart? All that transportation costs and other things that we're using to get into those states. I know in our community, when someone takes down a building or adjacent up to 75 miles, they're running it to Roberts County Landfill. So I agree with Representative Heinzman that we have to look at the full story. I do appreciate the hearing. I do appreciate getting this debate out there, because even when I was mayor 10, 12 years ago, and now it's even more difficult to clean up these unsightly properties and have economic growth because of the cost that it takes to with waste and even grass clipping. So that's what I wanted to share. I do appreciate that time to share that, because out here we're solving that problem going into another state, and I don't think it's wise for states to take waste and put it in another state because of the regulatory environment in Minnesota. So thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Strohmeyer, if you could maybe just mention how the testimony is available as we switch over. Thank you, Mr. Benke. And we're going to go to Ms. Wallerstedt to talk about a legacy site that is massive that we need to deal with. So, Mr. Strohmeyer.
Mr. Chair, the testimony is posted on the committee website. If you go to the meeting notice, it's under attachments. We've combined the written testimony on topic areas for ease of for members and for staff, and this is kind of similar to how cities, counties, and local units of government include their electronic packets on the on their public websites as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Wallerstedt, welcome again.
Thank you, Chair. Again, my name is Jamie Wallerstedt, Division Director at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I also have Hans Navy present, who is the manager for this site. So what we're talking about here is one site eligible for MILCAT funds, and that's the Pig's Eye Landfill. Next slide. So the Pig's Eye Landfill is located in St. Paul. We have the Mississippi River to the west, Pig's Eye Lake to the south, and then Highway 1061 to the north and east there. Also adjacent to the Met Council Environmental Services Wastewater Treatment Plant. Just by way of background, Pig's Eye Dump is the largest unpermitted dump in the state of Minnesota. And it is located within the Mississippi River floodplain. The operational history from 1956 to 1972, 8.3 million cubic yards of industrial, commercial, and municipal waste were disposed of on approximately 230 acres of the site. In 1977 to 1985, the Met Council disposed of sewage sludge ash on 31 acres that was permitted. The contaminants of concern are PFAS, perfluorinated alkyl substances, metals, mercury, PCBs, also known as polychlorinated biphenyls, VOCs, volatile organic compounds, and then FVOCs, which are semi-volatile organic compounds, dioxins, furans, and 1,4-dioxane. One note about 1,4-dioxane, it was not sampled for previously. The MPCA decided to sample for it knowing that 1,4-dioxane has been detected in so many of our closed landfills, and it was discovered in 2021. Next slide. So this is an illustration that we wanted to put up here to depict how the contaminants moving within the waste are transported to the sediments in Pig's Eye Lake. The waste is near the water. The waste is, it's labeled there on the screen, but what it does is when there is rain infiltrates through that waste, that rainwater will infiltrate through the waste and can carry contaminants to the stream that's flowing through that, which is Battle Creek. It also can take the contaminants directly out into the sediment within Pig's Eye Lake as well. And then the circles on the bottom there are showing how contaminants can move through a biological system and contaminate worms and bugs, then in turn can carry that contamination to frogs and fish, and then from the fish to humans. Next slide. So some of the work that we have done at the PCA at Pig's Eye Dump, so from 2000 to 2005, we did initial cleanup work. We removed hazardous waste drums from the site. That picture is from that removal at the top of the slide. We also cleaned up lead contaminated surface soil, and we installed a soil cap on the waste footprint to help minimize infiltration through there. We installed a select fill barrier where the waste and the water interface along Battle Creek is located. And what that is doing is as that water is moving through the waste and picking up contaminants, it moves through that barrier of select fill, and what that select fill does then removes the contamination before it gets to Battle Creek. And then from 2006 to present, we've been monitoring the soil, groundwater, surface water, sediment, and landfill gas, and we've also been monitoring that remedy that was in place in 2005. But as you can see, the next couple of slides, our next steps are a remedy evaluation. So if you can go to the next slide. So as I talked about, that previous approach to mitigate PFAS to Battle Creek was installing the permeable reactive barrier, also called a PRB, where the contaminated water can move through. And it's that select fill that absorbs the contaminants before it gets to the creek. And one thing about the select fill is it must be designed and then also monitored to capture that specific contaminant plume. And then It needs to be monitored for the years to come because those select fills are like a filter and they can clog up eventually. So we've been monitoring that. Next slide. So this is some of the more recent work we've been doing. We need to, like I said, continue to monitor that select fill that's in that reactive barrier. We've also been studying whether to implement another permeable reactive barrier. So from 2018 to 2020, we've been studying different select fill formulations on their effectiveness to remove different contaminants that are present at Pig's Eye. And in 2021, we designed an investigation to fill some data gaps that we have. And so we went out and did some of that sampling, and that's when we first sampled and detected 1,4-dioxane. Our plan for 2022 to 2024, because 1,4-dioxane is present, we do need to fill additional data gaps as to how widespread that is. We need to better understand the water level changes during flooding events. We're looking at the water interactions, and we're also looking at upgradient impacts because, as you know, Battle Creek is flowing through the site, and there are upgradient impacts that were found as well. So we need to update the site models to support the best approach and remedy for the long-term effectiveness. And then beginning in 2025, we'll have to design and implement a selected remedy and move into long-term monitoring as well. And then this is a summary slide of the costs from all four of the closed demolition landfills that I talked about earlier, in addition to the Pig's Eye dump. So as you can see, in fiscal year 2022, we are looking at spending approximately $200,000 to help fill some of those data gaps and do more investigation. And then from 2023 to 2027, we're looking at spending approximately $11 million to implement an additional permeable reactive barrier. However, we are studying the short-term and the long-term remedies at this site, so that number is subject to change depending on those studies that we're completing. And so the total cost that we're planning to spend out of the MILCAT fund is $660,000 this fiscal year, and then $13.5 million in the subsequent 5 years. So with that, I will take any questions, Chair.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that presentation. Could you go into a little more detail on those select fill absorbent systems? What exactly does that involve? Are you adding different absorbent specialized chemicals to regular soil? Do you have the ability to, you have to change that stuff out? Very curious about that. And are you working with private industry on the latest absorbent materials that may exist out there? Thank you.
Ms. Wallerstedt.
Chair and Representative, yes, the different formulations include not necessarily chemical additives. They're carbon. It's about your carbon content. And so different levels of carbon, we've tested those in the past, and we'll continue to test those as different levels of carbon can adsorb different chemicals. And to answer the second question, private industry, we are working with a consultant to help us with that study and studying publicly available products.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that answer. I know that we've got some small systems up in our area in north central Minnesota, where we are using manufactured absorbent used, there's ability to repurpose peat. And that stuff will pick up a variety of heavy metals and all kinds of stuff. And in some circumstances, they can actually release that stuff. Obviously, they have to take the absorbent out and replace it when they do that. But so there are some pretty advanced technology out there that at least at a demonstration level is being used in different parts. I mean, we got some parking lots that have got small collection systems and a filtration system up in our area that are using some relatively new, when I say stuff that's came on the market in the last 24 to 36 months. Please, if you've got any questions on that, I'll definitely provide you with that information. Thank you.
Ms. Wallerstedt.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Chair and Representative.
Councillor Prince, I'm going to make sure that we have questions from the members first before I go to you. I want to make sure that members have any questions. Ms. Wallerstedt, I think I've seen a map, and maybe if you could put the map back up, or if you have another map of the site that would show just maybe the proximity of Pig's Eye Lake to the Mississippi. And then I think the sludge disposal is on the 230-acre site. I seem to remember seeing the 31 acres, and then there wasn't there a couple acre car battery dump as well on the site. If maybe you can show on the map where some of these things are, and I'm assuming that blue ribbon going through the middle of it is Battle Creek. That's correct. If you could maybe describe the site a little bit.
Sure, Mr. Chair, and I'm gonna have Hans Navy come on to maybe describe it a little bit more. And while he is coming on, it is, Alexis, I'm not able to show my cursor, but that creek running through, directly through, is Battle Creek. Thank you. Thank you, Alexis. And
Mr.
Hans
Navy,
do you want to describe where the ash disposal was?
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Hans Navy. I'm a manager at MPCA. The early cleanup that began about 2000 and addressed an area we called the battery disposal area. I'm also unable to point exactly where it is. I mean, this is, if you can see the intersection of the dump and Pig's Eye Lake, about in the middle of that, there was an area where previously Pig's Eye Lake inundated more into the area of the dump. Yes, right about there. This was an area where batteries were cracked and there was high levels of lead found, and a cleanup was done in that area with the lead contaminated soil being removed, and the low area that did have Pig's Eye Lake intruding to it was filled in. So that addresses that location. The MCES permitted sludge ash disposal is more in the western part of the dump. So yes, right about in this area, yes.
And Mr. Navy, but for the road and maybe human activity, the traditional floodplain would go over the dump if there was flooding?
Yes, this is a very unfortunately situated large body of waste. It is frequently flooded by Mississippi River flooding. So it's not a thing that will happen. It's a thing that we frequently see. This area is flooded.
Members, any questions? Okay, next we will go to St. Paul City Councilor Jane Prince to provide testimony, and we have some additional testimony as well. So welcome, Councilor Prince.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. And I am really grateful for this opportunity. I'll be brief. I want to call your attention to the resolution unanimously passed by the St. Paul City Council and signed by the mayor, seeking your support for this timely opportunity to allocate cleanup funds to the Pig's Eye Superfund site. For all of us, I think for our state, it helps us to reverse the human degradation that made a Superfund site of St. Paul's largest lake and wetland habitat. It gets ahead of climate disruptions that could further endanger downstream communities relying on the river for drinking water. It honors our natural and indigenous history while serving some of our city's most multicultural neighborhoods. And finally, of course, for all of us, it contributes to restoring the health of one of the great waterways of the world. So I appreciate your consideration, and we stand at the ready to be available for anything that staff or legislators may need in the way of further information or support.
Councillor, are you hearing from constituents about this?
Very much so. We had, when we put the resolution on the agenda last week, we have heard from hundreds of people in organizations that are very excited about this opportunity. It has been, frankly, just dangerous and really ugly what has happened to our wetland and lake down there. And I think it's a, people see this as a really significant cleanup for the region. I also heard from Congresswoman McCollum's office that she is also reaching out to the National Park Service, the EPA, and the Corps of Engineers to assist us.
Members, any questions for Councillor Prince? Councillor, I think we're getting a bill drafted to look at establishing maybe a short-term commission of 4 years to bring all the interests together, because there's the city responsibility, the various local governments, the counties, the federal agencies, and so we're getting that drafted, and I'd like to get that to you and the St. Paul delegation, if possible, as soon as we get that done.
Thank you, Chair Hansen, and I do want to particularly note that Mary DeLay, who heads up our Great River Passage for the Mississippi River in St. Paul, is available to testify here today, and she can speak to specifics of the plan that has been put together for that part of the river.
Thank
as
you,
well as Tom Diamond, who has done a ton of work building a constituency for the park over the last 30 years.
They are up next. So
very good.
Ms. DeLay.
Well, thank you, Chair Hansen and members, and frankly, thank you, Councilmember Prince. My name is Mary DeLate, and I'm the Executive Director of the Great River Passage Conservancy. Our purview is the 17 miles of the Mississippi River that flows through St. Paul, and our vision really is to build St. Paul as the river capital, because as most of you know, St. Paul has more river, river's edge, and publicly owned land than any city the entire length of the Mississippi River. And of course, Minnesota is the headwaters state with more river than any other state the entire length of the Mississippi River. Our goal really is to bring the river from the edge back to the center of public life, and we're doing that through three capital projects, one of which is called the East Side River District, which is the Pig's Eye area. As you know from Councilmember Prince and the others speaking, this is 1,000 acres of extremely dynamic, complicated, and sensitive landscape. It's not just a flooding riparian landscape. We have industry down there. We have infrastructure. We have regional parks. We have Dakota significant and sacred sites. 40% of all migrating birds coming up the Mississippi go through there, and as well as having these two Superfund sites. We have been leading on a project, again, the Eastside River District, for which I provided a 6-page document for background for all of you. Our goal really is to reveal, heal, connect, and protect this 1,000 acres. How do we reveal the very complicated story of this area? How do we heal a compromised landscape, which of course for today's discussion is terribly important? How do we connect people to this landscape, which of course the community has been disconnected from this area, and also it's quite a difficult area for all the industry down there to coexist in? And then last but not least, how do we protect this area, not only from a Dakota significant and site perspective, but also from an environmental perspective? So it's really important for us to have this partnership both with the state and the feds, and this opportunity for potential cleanup funds, because that could be really transformative for this area, and also catalyze our ability to move our project forward, which will have an impact not only on St. Paul, but on the larger environment, the communities, the health and well-being of everyone downriver as well. So thank you for this opportunity, and I'm happy to answer any questions about what we're doing.
Any questions? Thank you. Tom Diamond.
Thank you, Chair. Just to follow up on what Jane and Mary spoke about, this is a national park. And so people are aware this is a huge natural resource with amazing characteristics. Unfortunately, the large amounts of toxic material and other waste was dumped directly into the water. It's in the water table in the wetlands, and it's still there today. The exploratory work that has been done along the creek that was shown to you, just in that, they pulled out hundreds of 55-gallon drums full of every kind of toxic chemical or waste that you can imagine. You can walk through the park today, and I can show you 55-gallon drums sticking up out of the ground, rusting away today. The vast majority of the area hasn't even been opened up to see what's in there. What we're talking about is actual cleanup of the site and restoration of the natural resources to protect humans and the wildlife that live there. The rookery, which is an amazing asset here, testing of PCBs in particular, but waste in eggs that have been done have shown some of the highest levels of pollutant found in the world. Now, you can't necessarily tie the decline in the rookery that we've seen to that, but we know that a healthy environment with healthy habitat for not only the bird population, but the other wildlife here is better for humans and better for wildlife and a better asset for our community. We are seeing PFAS in the drinking water wells of the adjoining neighborhoods. It's getting into the water table, affecting people. I think it's helpful to look at what has come out of the Superfund efforts on the federal level, which hopefully can be one of the pieces here. Senators Schumer and Gillibrand talked about that we need to jumpstart the toxic waste cleanup, and that removing PFAS to protect health is important. The EPA's administrator points out that 1 in 4 Black and Hispanic Americans live within 3 miles of a Superfund site. and that EPA is working to serve people that have been left behind. Senator Tom Carper, who is the chair of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, said that addressing legacy pollution is not only the right thing to do, it is also directly benefits nearby communities by improving public health, creating good-paying jobs, and shielding these sites from spreading more contamination in the event of climate change-fueled storms. This is directly in the path of that sort of problem, threat. The neighborhoods surrounding Big Zay Dump Superfund site are BIPOC majority and historically underserved communities. PFAS is a pollutant in the Superfund site. We have a real opportunity to make a big difference in the long haul if we clean up this site. And that is what, thankfully, the efforts of the City Council and many members of the community are working for, and look forward to working with the committee and others to find a path to, in that direction. I take any questions if there are.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you to the testifiers who spoke today, but also the ones who submitted extensive written testimony. I spent a lot of time reviewing that last night, and I heard over and over again from people who actually use this space to recreate, which makes sense because I know in Legacy, we've invested heavily in outdoor heritage from the Outdoor Heritage Fund and preserving wildlife habitat here. And it sounds like we might have a problem with our investment in this area, but I'm curious about the people that Mr. Diamond spoke really eloquently about. Can you talk to me about the number of people that use this space to recreate and what kinds of activities they that your constituents and that folks in the neighborhood try to do in this area? Kayaking, a lot of bird watchers I see.
I would be glad to. It's more of a demand. There are plenty of people who use it today, but one of the reasons why the community has not been able to use it in the way that it should be is because of the pollution. The Met Council recently reviewed an update of the plan for the park, and they warned that really you shouldn't be implementing efforts to allow people into here because of the environmental threat to humans along with the wildlife in the area. And so that has hampered the ability to provide the paths, the hiking trails, the signage access and stuff into the park. It is another example of that our park, St. Paul's Parks Department plan to plant trees down in the site. And they were told, nope, you can't do that because of the danger of digging down into this material and hitting the pollutant, which gets back to the issue of that we've got a national park, which we put a lot of commitment into trying to protect and restore. And if we don't clean up this site, actually get in there and get this pollutant out of there, we are hampered from doing our duties to protect the wildlife, protect the human beings who live here, and keep in mind that these are populations that who have not seen the kind of resources that other communities have to, they don't necessarily have the cabins, the places to go that they can enjoy the natural resources that others can. And so it's really time to get serious about this and move on the cleanup.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you.
And if I could just add to that, when you do figure out how to get in there, and the St. Paul Parks Department is planning to create more of an entrance area so that people can walk in and walk toward the lake, but it is extraordinarily beautiful. And the number of eagles that you see down there, it really is. And as Mary said, 40% of migratory birds that come up the Mississippi River fly over that area. As a neighbor, I see pelicans, I see bluebirds. It's extraordinary. So I know one thing that we would be happy to do is if any legislators would, once the weather gets a little bit better, we would be happy to arrange a tour of the area. And I think you would be just truly inspired.
Representative Jordan, we're running out of time, so I'm going to go to Representative Jordan and make sure we've got questions. So.
Yep. I guess my final question then is I am concerned about one of the questions, reasons why I asked about what kinds of activities people use to recreate or what kinds of activities people would like to, what amenities the community around there would like to have is because I am concerned about the effects that the waste from this dump has had on fish. And we know there's extensive research showing the effects that when pregnant people eat fish that are contaminated with many of the chemicals that have been described today that has adverse outcomes on the health of their future children and the health of the pregnant person. And so I'm wondering, and so are people able to fish? We also know this has, I've heard a lot of testimony about birds. We know that this does negatively impact our bird population. Can you talk to me a little bit about the effects that you've seen that this has had on people who would like to fish? Are people fishing in the area? Are there warnings that they might be eating contaminated fish? Or are people just completely unable to fish or use this water for water-based recreation?
I'm going to go to Councillor Prince just because it's a City of St. Paul property and any signage and what are the warnings?
Council member, thank you.
I should know that, and I don't. I believe that the areas where people fish along the river in St. Paul are marked as with warnings about eating the fish. But I must say, Tom probably knows more about this than I do, or Mary. I would urge you to answer that question. It is not very accessible for people looking to fish. But I don't know if people are using it for fishing. Can you answer that, Tom?
Mr. Diamond?
Yes, there is a DNR warning against eating the fish. And part of the MPCA's plan calls for cleanup of sediment in the lake because this is traveling, the pollutants are traveling into the lake and are in the sediments of the lake.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have any further questions, but I do really want members of the committee to pay note to a sentiment that was described where people in this community don't have the ability to go to other places to fish or participate in outdoor recreation, but they do contribute to, you know, our legacy funds. They contribute to our taxpaying funds, and they deserve to have access to the river, and they deserve to have access to that outdoor recreation that everyone is a part of. I represent Northeast Minneapolis. And we don't have this exact problem, but we are reliant on the river for outdoor recreation, and to have communities deprived of that when they when the Mississippi River goes right through them and they do have this access to lakes is unacceptable. And, I don't represent this area, but I strongly support efforts to clean this area up and provide that riverfront access for communities.
I'm going to go back to Ms. Wallerstedt or Mr. Knave, and sewage sludge was burned, did that concentrate toxics or heavy metals in that ash? And has there been any monitoring of that ash disposal on the site?
Oh. Sorry, I was having problems getting off mute. Chair, I'm going to ask Hans to discuss the sampling of the ash.
Mr. Navy.
Coming on?
Yes, thank you. With the sewage sludge ash, one of the things we're concerned about is metals and also now PFAS. So these are both part of the monitoring program at the Pigside Dump. I would need to look more closely at the file, be more specific about exactly which wells are adjacent, how many wells, and the frequency of sampling, but it is part of the monitoring program. And it is a contamination that we're concerned about.
Is the waste on the surface or is it capped?
It is capped. There's a cover over the sewage sludge ash.
Is there any lining?
My understanding is no. There's a 2-foot soil cap, but no lining.
Members, any other questions?
Chair Hansen, could I make an offer, please? Earlier on, when you were speaking, you were talking about convening a group of people around the stakeholders around this project. We at the Great River Passage host regular convenings for all the stakeholders so that everybody knows exactly who's doing what in this area, because in fact, there are 10 or 12 different public partners with 23 different projects going on down there. And so I would offer to you, if you wanted any sort of foundational information, both contact information and project information, we are happy to share that.
That would be very helpful. And I should note, Representative Jay Zhang has been a leader on this and I know has been working with you and I think was going to carry that. So let's work together on that. And Representative Heintzman, if we can engage on this, that would be great. I want to go back to the sewage ash just for a moment. And that's a lot of waste and we don't know what's in it. So are the monitoring wells, is there soil sampling that's going on? Beyond the wells, is there, are we doing any testing of vegetation or insects or let's say aquatic life or even birds, et cetera? Are we doing any sampling there of kind of the biological chain to see about accelerated contamination? Mr. Knave or Ms. Wallerstein?
Go ahead, Hans, you're more familiar. Thank you.
Yeah, so with pig's eye, we're concerned about the contaminants in the dump getting into the waste stream and into the lake. The monitoring we're doing now is focused on the groundwater, which is contaminated. There's also been an extensive amount of sampling in the sediments that are in Pig's Eye Lake. When we do sampling of the sediments, what we're comparing the results to are really ecological criteria. So we say this amount of contamination in the sediment is hazardous for the ecosystem, for the benthic invertebrates, for the animals that live in the sediment. But that's what the focus is right now. It's the data we're collecting now, the ongoing monitoring program is about the groundwater. There is also existing data that shows that the sediments are contaminated. We've done much less of what you're talking about, which in terms of sampling organisms. Years ago, there was a look at the deer population of pigs. I would need to refresh on exactly what that data said. And as part of the ecological work, there's also work that can be done to sample the benthic invertebrates. But really the best way is to look at what's in the sediment and compare that against the standards of what levels would be safe.
There's millions of people down the Mississippi River downstream from this site, all the way to the, now granted, some of these heavy metals can be somewhat stable, but you know, this legacy can have a long lasting legacy and a long reaching legacy. I think members, just to tie all this together, the MLCAT fund was set up in the 80s to kind of deal with waste, and the waste legacy problem is larger than we thought. Even if it had not been raided, it's unlikely that it would be able to cover on its own some of these large legacy sites. But with that raid, and not only missed out on the investment income, but the dollars to be available to fund not only Pig's Eye Dump, but also other sites throughout the metro area where residents paid fees to go into that for this purpose and have for quite some time. We have precedent in Minnesota and in this country with the Great Lakes Initiative on cleaning up legacy sites. And it's been a 10 to 12 year effort where the state has put in money to match federal money to clean up old sites. Similar efforts are being proposed for the Mississippi River. I think the question for the PCA and that we would continue to look at as we move through this session is with federal dollars that are coming in. This is not a traditional Superfund site. It's an old dump. And how do we try to attract federal dollars for health and safety and cleanup, for brownfield cleanup on this site, and what exactly state dollars are needed to match that to make that happen? We have met with Congresswoman McCollum's office. I think there's opportunity in the federal budget process to try to get dollars here, and we would want to maximize this because literally millions of people live downstream from this site. It is in a national park. It's been ignored for a very long time, and we need to deal with it. So we have to adjourn. I want to make sure I give Representative Heintzman the opportunity before we close if he has any questions or comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I covered most of my concerns earlier, so appreciate the opportunity for a closing comment.
Thank you, members, and thank you to the testifiers and to those watching at home. I'd encourage you to look at the testimony, particularly the last testifier in writing, prior MPCA employee work on the site. With that, we are adjourned. We will see you during the regular session.